Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between everything going on in our world that affects our well-being, the well-being of our families, communities, neighborhoods, regions, our whole society, as well as the ecological balance of planet Earth. I'm a journalist covering health, food, the environment, media, policy, and popular beliefs and attitudes from a progressive perspective here on Progressive Radio for now going on 8 years. And each week we bring in different authors, advocates, filmmakers, scholars, scientists, and ordinary people in communities to talk about what's going on in our world, how it affects us, and how we take action. On this week's show, I'm really delighted to have with us H. Bruce Franklin. He's the author of a terrific new book called Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. Daniel Ellsberg himself has given a front cover quote to this book, calling it a terrific book, and it is indeed. Bruce Franklin has a very interesting background. He's a former Air Force navigator and intelligence officer, as well as a progressive activist. That's not, you know, something you find combined in a single human life every day. he is the John Cotton Dana Professor of English and American Studies, emeritus at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. He's a cultural historian that in this book, Crash Course, offers a set of hand-learned lessons about modern American history. He's also the author and editor of 19 books and has received a Lifetime Achievement Award, actually multiple awards, from the American Studies Association and other major academic organizations. I'm delighted to welcome you, Bruce Franklin, to Connect the Dots.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Allison, and, you know, connecting the dots, that's what I do.
Yes. Yes, that's really evident from your book. And the thing that's really interesting is, you know, as one who is, you know, kind of active today in progressivism, as are many of the journalists and advocates and activists that come on this program, you know, one of the things that you provide in this book, Crash Course, is a sort of cultural sweep. You know, we have a whole generation of younger progressives coming along now. Those of us who are, you know, elder are kind of, you know, happy to see sort of this follow-up generation that is kind of reaping the harvest of the lessons, you know, that we were animated by back in the boomer youth years. But your perspective goes back even farther in that, you know, all the way back to service and some of the wars that to many are just kind of distant history. And that is, you know, there's a lot of really, I would say, important American history seen through a personal lens is really how I would characterize this book, so that it's not dry history, it's kind of living history. And there's also the trajectory in the book of your moving from a sort of politically naive person who bought into the, you know, cultural myths of that time when you were growing up in America to, you know, increasingly moving toward a progressive stance in a whole bunch of different ways. So I think that's really kind of unique, and a great gift of the book is to see that journey. So that one of the things that I found really fascinating is your ability to look back to the early Cold War period and even earlier, to the sort of roots of our fear and concern about communism as a nation. And that's particularly relevant nowadays because, you know, as we have democratic socialists and openly socialist candidates, you know, coming in with needed solutions, you know, there's still this kind of fear of communism and Russia and all of that, and you actually came from that kind of fear yourself, and then kind of had your eyes opened in a certain kind of way. Can we discuss, you know, your own history and experience, and you know what it was like coming of age and then living through, you know, the kind of Cold War epoch?
Yeah, well, Allison, you're being charitable because actually my beliefs, I grew up in World War II, and my beliefs were radically changed in the first years after World War II, so that I was pretty far right, not on social issues, but on political issues. I thought Douglas MacArthur was a great hero. I was for Joe McCarthy. I was fervent.
Really?
And anti-communist. I was coming from that place. And I think one thing that makes my experience and my attempt to narrate that experience particularly useful here is that I think everybody recognizes that we live in a divided country. I think everybody across the political spectrum recognizes that we have a dysfunctional government. And this is sort of surprising, but it's there when you have any experience with it. There's no support for all these wars that we're waging. Or these are the wars being waged by a government which everybody thinks is dysfunctional, the swamp, as Trump calls it, and we're so divided that, you know, for people who are progressives, we tend to see these people who support this Republican government, Trump and so forth, as bad. And you know, these are not bad people. There are some bad people among them, but that 40% of Americans, will, you know, give or take, who support the Republicans, support Trump, most of them are not bad people. And so I'm coming from a perspective where I had some of the same ideas. So I know how the world looks to these people. And so part of the book is an attempt to frame a dialogue that cuts across this spectrum and can unite with people who may have radical differences with on some social issues, but we have much in common with in not wanting to have a government that takes the biggest slice of our productivity, our resources, of those trillions and trillions of dollars, uses them in ways that actually destroy our educational system, our health system, our ridiculous infrastructure, and of course the environment of not only our nation but the planet. And that's what I try to do in the book. And what I do here, it's a little hard to describe, but here's one way to look at it. So here's historical reality out there. We call it history. And then there's what I believed was reality. And then the experience is that every now and then, sort of key points in my life, parts of reality came and hit me over the head. So it was these things that forced me to take another look at historical reality. And that's what I've been doing in this book and, you know, a number of other books. So, you know, some particular. So a B-47 bomber blowing up just as we were about to refuel it. I was a navigator and intelligence officer in mid-air refueler. And that near-death experience led me into a path of research while I was still in the Air Force, and that was still pretty gung-ho, that led me deeper and deeper, you bring up Russia, into the realization that anti-communism of my 1940s, mid-40s, 1950s years, my belief that then the Soviet Union, now Russia, was an enemy, was founded on lies and a inversion of historical reality. Russia was not our enemy. They were not threatening us in any way. We turned them into our enemy. North Korea. We began our war with North Korea before the end of World War II. I mean, you could put your finger on the date. It was August, the night of August 11th, 12th, 1945, a few days before the war ended, that we divided Korea against the will of the Korean people into two nations and set up a dictatorship in the South or on the domestic front. I don't know how many people have seen the movie Out on the Waterfront. I was a mate on a tugboat. I was standing on a bunch of old towing lines. There was sort of the bumper of the tugboat about to throw a line when I see something in the water. Turns out to be a longshoreman who had been assassinated. He had a bag hook in the back of his neck, which is a sign of how they assassinated people, to realize that we were in a war raging all around me on the waterfront, which leads me back to do historical research to discover that during World War II, when I was this gung-ho kid, the U.S. Navy, operating for the U.S. government, actually made a pact with organized crime to run the waterfront in order to impose discipline on the workers. So that what we see in that famous movie is a reversal of historical reality. So these are just a couple of examples of how the experience with reality hitting me on the head leads to an understanding of historical reality, which then informs my activism in the period after I sort of came to my senses.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, you were, like many Americans are, you know, holding certain beliefs, influenced by what other people say and hear, and then something happens that's like a wake-up call that challenges that. And you have to shift your understanding and accept a new reality. And this has happened, you know, periodically, consistently throughout your life. I mean, you know, of course, we're in a big wake-up call moment now, you know, for example. I just, you know, before we go back and further into some of these moments of history, I'm just wondering, where do you see, you know, you spoke of the divisions and the fact that people on both sides of this divide are having false ideas about the people on the other side, misunderstandings, they're not seeing commonalities. That would seem to be, you know, that's a major perspective. You know, how does that play out, or what other misunderstandings, you know, are people operating under that you see? Like, for example, what is the misunderstanding on the right? What's the misunderstanding in the liberal sector? What's the misunderstanding in the progressive, you know, sector, according to, you know, what you've learned in your perspective? I just would love to hear that.
Yeah, well, I guess what it goes back to is the relationship between the American people and the government. And, you know, I talked about my experience. My experience is not by any means unique. So if we look back to, say, the mid-50s, the American people believed in our government. We believed that this was a government that represented the interests of the people as a whole. I'm not just saying that because there's a scientific way of evaluating it. The University of Michigan, every 2 years since the mid-50s, has done this very extensive polling about people's belief about the government. It's one key question is, does the government represent the interests of the American people as a whole, or just a small group? And in 1954, 75% of the American people, 76%, believed this is the government of that represents the interests of all the people. Only a tiny minority did not believe that. By 1974, that's 20 years later, it's exactly reversed. 75% of the American people now believe that the government did not represent the interests of the American people, that represented the interests of a tiny minority. That's a dramatic shift in consciousness. I was one of those people, but we're talking about tens and tens of millions of people. So, cutting across the political spectrum today, right, left, blue, red, I think you'd still have general agreement that this is not a government that represents the interests of the people. Then people, go in different directions with this. But that's one way to talk to people who may be way on the other side in what divides us. So then we have to get back to, why? Follow the money is a simple way to begin that discussion. But also, and this is a way you can't escape having to know something about history, the understanding that these various governments, Democratic, Republican, whatever, representing this small group, the 1%, I think is a good way to put it, has consistently lied to the American people so that what we believe is history is actually just a great construct of lies over and over again. So you cannot understand what's going on until you sort of pierce that network of lies and get to see where we are historically. And then a lot of things flow from that. A big part of the book is about my experience within the movement after I came to my senses. And to understand something about that movement, you mentioned it, Allison, young people today, which it's so inspiring to see young people in motion today. It's that tremendous energy and awareness. We all need to see, whether we're real old like me or real young like other people, the connection between the movement that exists today and the movement that emerged with tremendous power in the late 1960s and early 1970s. That movement has never gone away. It's there. It's a powerful river, and these other forces are actually reactionary forces, energized by what they see as history going in the wrong direction. So the progressive movements today are part of that river that reactionary forces are reacting against. So to think of us as the resistance may be wrong. Michelle Alexander had a good piece on this recently. I mean, actually, the resistance to the progressive river is reactionary. And we need to understand the power that progressive people have, but that power needs to be much better informed than it is to really gain its strength.
Mm-hmm. What would you regard as, what would be a corrective on the perspective and, better informed about what?
Well, the history in which we live, the larger history, but also the history of the movement. You know, there's a lot of depression, and people think, why isn't there this mass participation that we once had back in the 60s? Well, if to take the Iraq War for example, the demonstrations against the Iraq War were actually larger than the largest demonstrations against the Vietnam War. So there's that coherence and consistency of the movement. It was, I say, it's still present. I think a lot of the strength today is coming from a single issue things, and that's fine. Except people need to understand the connection between all the progressive single issues and the overarching war economy, war politics, and war culture that is the enemy of all these progressive single issues.
Okay, that makes complete sense. So is that is it capitalism? Is it corporatism? You know, what is the organization that is creating the oppression of some people, the economic oppression, the personal oppression, the racism? Like, what is the chief mechanism of that, in your view?
Well, obviously it's capitalism. It's a kind of capitalism. We live in a plutocracy. We have a government now. We're talking about a predator, Kavanaugh. But this is a government of predators. It's an extremely predatory form. I think a word that we have to put front and center in our vocabulary is imperialism. You cannot understand this without recognizing that we live in an empire, which may be the final form of capitalism, because it could be the final form because it leads to the extermination of our species.
Right.
And so we tend not to ask that question that little kids ask would drive you crazy if they asked it two or three times, which is why. You know, why is it that we are making the primary goal of the society so-called defense? Defense of what? I mean, if we go back to that crucial period after World War II, this is the period which the War Department, its name was changed to the Department of Defense, defense against what? Against whom? Who are the enemies? So instead of seeing a defense against, we'll talk about education, ignorance, we have organized defense of ignorance. this is why we have this attack on public education. You know, why Betsy DeVos is in charge of public education. This is very systematic. If we talk about of health, there's an organized attack Again, on health, the defense should be against disease. When we get to the environment, it's obvious. It's hardly we're saying we have an organized defense of the forces that are the most dangerous for the environment. Coal, methane. So we ask the question why we get to beginning to peel away all the lies and misconceptions that we have about the organization of our society and why it is that we're doing things which is so obviously, when you think about it, irrational and opposed to our interests.
So in all of those cases that I can think of, there's always a profit-oriented motive. There's a profit-oriented motive to pursue fossil fuel development and oppose environmental regulations. There's a profit-oriented motive to make for a costly healthcare system rather than doing the numerous things that could be done to protect people's health in terms of the educational system. If you have uneducated people, then they're not as well suited to be citizens. They're not informed. They don't know what's going on. If there's an attack on the press, same problem. Is there something beside the profit orientation that is, in your view, the mechanism that's creating this dynamic? I mean, how would you add militarism and imperialism into that particular mix? Is that the overriding source of profit or economic agenda? Or, how does that come about?
Okay. Yes, if you begin with follow the money, it begins to unravel. You begin to get some clarity, but it's not simple because the people who are profiting, the institutions and individuals who are profiting from this irrationality, participate in creating a culture and a whole system of beliefs that makes this seem rational. And in so doing, it's not that they think of themselves as evil people who are just constructing these beliefs for other people. They believe them too, so they have a set of values, a culture, a way of relating to each other. So if we look at their behavior, if we view the the rich white guys who are governing us, we see that some of that culture in action. But then we also have to look at how their view of class and race and gender becomes part of the dominant culture of the society. So this is why I identify myself. People ask, what are you? Well, I'm a cultural historian. And this is where things get, not so simple, because you have to start disentangling. And when you do that, things really surprise you. I guess what you have to recognize is that this culture exists inside your own head. And I had an experience. I did this book called MIA, or a myth-making in America about the construction of this belief that Vietnam held all these American POWs after the war. In that book, I go through the movies, the Rambo movies, and so forth, and all these other things that made this not just a lie, because that was created as a lie. It was Nixon and Perot who actually sat down and created this idea that POWs were being held, but then it became a myth. Which is very powerful in the culture. Anthropologists understand this. They look at the myths of a society to understand, how does the society work? So I realized that as this myth developed, the POW, say John McCain, the POW was being projected as an icon of militism, as one of the most effective ways to militarize the society. And I saw all this. So I was in Japan in 1991, teaching at a Japanese university in Tokyo for a month. And one night, some Japanese scholars of American studies were talking with me, and they were very, very interested in the whole POW-MIA myth. So they said, we've looked at the movies. We see you're right. It's an icon of militarism. That's how it's working. And they said, but that's what we don't understand, because when militarism was dominant in Japanese society, the last person who would be an icon of militarism would be the prisoner of war. What did he do? That was heroic. He surrendered. He didn't fight to the death. So how does that work? They asked me. So I thought I understood this myth inside out. I was totally flummoxed. This amazed me. I said, I don't understand this myth. I had to go back and look at the movies again, read the stuff again, to realize that this myth was a myth of misogyny. That the main targets of the myth were things like feminism. And you don't believe me? I have an extended analysis of the movies to see how that works. It's right there. So a lot of the core beliefs of the right wing today are inculcated through that POW myth. But the key thing about this story is that it was inside my own head, and that's why I didn't see it, because it's very hard to look inside your own head and start to untangle that mess that's in there of your cultural beliefs and awarenesses. So
without a doubt, but I'm trying to understand how. I get the basic point, which is, we've all internalized this, but what I'm not so clear about is what was the essence of the POW myth that, made it effective or shifted understanding? I'm not getting to the heart of that. You're saying it was a constructed myth, but what was it?
It was about American manhood emasculated. Mm. That's what it was about. It's right there today in the Kavanaugh.
Yes, it is. Yes.
And so it's he represents American manhood. With a treacherous conspiracy, women undermining this. The virtues of American manhood.
In fact, a lot of the various divides between the liberals and the right are around American manhood. I mean, racism, dislike of immigrants. I mean, this is actually, quite pervasive, isn't it? I mean, it informs, although not explicitly by the POWs, but doesn't the sort of riling of that concern form and it, you know, an important, or the defense of, I mean, the big defense is maybe the defense of American manhood or something like that, that overrides a lot of these different things, or is rather the underpinning. I mean, is that so in your opinion, or?
Well, it's used. This is not just historical lies, but cultural myths and beliefs and psychology,
mm-hmm.
And you know why. If you look at the defenses of Kavanaugh and how they work, you begin to understand the ties to these other cultural forces. That's putting it a little more abstract. I think there are other ways to cut into this. If we take the FBI, you know, so the solution that's offered to this, what's presented as a he says, she says issue, is to get the FBI to go investigate.
Mm-hmm.
My own contact with the FBI, which, I've 3,000 pages or so at the Berkeley Library FBI documents. The FBI has always been political. We look at how the FBI has been presented in fiction, in movies, the beliefs about it, and so forth. Whereas the reality for me, I guess I mentioned the things that all of a sudden came, pieces of reality came and hit me on the head. 1972, two dozen FBI agents kicking in our front door, pointing guns at my wife and kids and my 14-year-old daughter. Hears them coming down the hall, pulls on her jeans, doesn't have a chance to get a shirt. FBI points shotguns at her. She goes to put on her shirt, put that down. So they held her like that with a shotgun against the wall. So say this is the supposedly non-political, objective agency that's going to investigate to see whether we have a sexual predator. That's the contradiction between the reality that hit me over the head and the reality that's presented in the media now. Obviously, oh, great, the FBI is going to investigate and will arrive at the truth. It's always been political. And I love the title of your show, Allison, because it's all about connecting the dots.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm not a fan of the FBI, and I've wondered why the FBI has become, you know, the big ally to democracy suddenly. you know, just kind of a new development from my perspective, you know, that a lot of people have, you know, kind of come on board with. It's also puzzling to me, since we're talking about the FBI, why the FBI is both the group that's supposedly saving the day for, you know, this kind of tremendous overrule by the billionaires under the Trump administration, why the FBI, you know, has become the counter to that, delegitimizing the election due to purported Russian involvement. And so in that role, they're kind of an enemy to Trump. And one of the reasons that this current Kavanaugh nomination, which may or may not have been resolved by the time the show is aired. But, you know, one of the reasons it's being railroaded through is because it ostensibly provides protection to the president from the FBI. And now the FBI is coming in. My head is kind of turning with all of that. It's very confusing. You know, who is on what side here? You know, first the FBI is saving, you know, ostensibly America from Trump, and then the FBI is called in by Trump investigate these allegations. I find that whole thing very confusing. Do you have a take on that?
Well, you know, there's a sort of classic phrase for this. It's called splits in the ruling class. We have splits in the ruling class. And so, mm-hmm. you know, so those of us consider ourselves progressives, they go, who are we supposed to root for here? Well, it's not like that because, you know, every day I read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and I can see the split in the ruling class. And so you just point out one, you know, it is the FBI. They also probably more important for us think about Russia. So while Trump is at least making noises about being friendly with Russia, although the actual policies are terrible, the liberal media are beating the war drums every day and demonizing Russia. And it reminds me, this is really kind of strange. So it reminds me of what I tried to get at in those years after World War II, where we kids growing up in World War II were supposed to see the Russians as these wonderful heroes and allies and friends and so forth, and then bang, in the few years they transformed me and, you know, just about all the other kids into haters of Russia, the USSR, and feeling that the communists were about to attack the United States with bombers, which they didn't have, and overthrow our government. And the New York Times is the modern purveyor of very similar beliefs. And, you know, New York Times, CNN, and so forth, there's basically liberal media, they're trying to get more fervor to support anti-Russian moves, including things that are threatening the possibility of a thermonuclear war, like moving NATO right up to the borders of the Soviet Union. While Trump is making all these friendly noises about his buddy Putin, although that's not the way it's playing out in the UN.
So, you know, this whole thing is rather disorienting. I mean, is your personal view leaving Putin and Russia, the Red Scare elements of that, the dangers of, you know, kind of going to war, to a warlike stance vis-a-vis Russia, you know, would your preference, I mean, how do you think we can endure, you know, the democracy can endure the continuation of Trump as president and, you know, like this kind of nomination going through on the Supreme Court? What would be the outcome of that?
Well, that's a disaster. You know, people who didn't vote, you know, they need to get out and vote in November. I mean, the question of can we preserve American democracy? What's left of it? And I think the answer is the answer is basically no, unless we reverse the course of what's happening politically, and which means that we have to get away from militarism, the danger to me, from my experience, and why, you know, say crash course, we're very close to the possibility of a thermonuclear war, not because of intentions, but because we're creating the conditions for accidental. And we've come very, very close to that in the past. I think we're getting to that again today.
Mm-hmm. So even as all of this, and that would, you know, the dilemma is that that could be equally true under a Democratic administration as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, one reason that a lot of progressive people didn't vote in November 16 is because they knew that Hillary Clinton is a raging hawk, and very, very dangerous in that way. Again, we're dealing with splits in the ruling class, but the problem is that if these reactionary forces control the Supreme Court, which they have actually for quite a while, because if you go back to the year 2000, it was the Supreme Court by 5-4 vote that handed the victory to Bush. And so in some ways nothing's changed, but Kennedy voted for that. But they're cementing control of the Supreme Court, which is you cannot overstate the dangers of that. I mean, it's terrible. They are because they're desperate. This is when we have to understand they are reactionary. They're moving against the main flow of progress here. They're desperate, which is why they are trying to prevent people from voting, controlling the vote, controlling as many governorships as possible in order to prevent, obviously, people of color from voting. Trying, you know, every conceivable move they can make to get to maintain and increase their political control. So I do see, you know, very, very important differences between the Republican and Democratic parties on those issues, on health, on education, and on the environment. This is all important, and we can't afford to confuse that with the fact that on the overriding issue of war and peace, that the Democratic Party has been just as bad as the Republican Party, and extremely dangerous. Whoever is in government, they are going to lie to us. They are going to the president of the United States is going to be for the near future anyway. Hopefully not forever, but for the near future, the president of the United States is the head of an empire, and is going to act like the head of an empire. As far as relationships with the rest of the world, which is why we're completely. When you get to the General Assembly in the UN, we are completely isolated. The only country that votes consistently with the United States is Israel.
Well, that's. I mean, the whole picture isn't looking very good. It's kind of ironic because, and you know, we have to kind of begin concluding the show. But you know, you came along and actually fought in World War II. You know, in which we were defending against.
I was just a kid in World War II.
No, but it was during the Korean War, right? But you grew up under that, you know, in that time,
right.
And now we are, you know, kind of, we have become the authoritarian power that we formally went to war to defend against.
Well, that's why the subtitle of Crash Course is From the Good War to the Further Right. I don't think World War II was a good war. I think that we lost that war. We lost the war to the forces that we supposedly were fighting against. And that's, you know, that's a main component of the book, for sure. But, I mean, I'm not pessimistic. I think this is a very dangerous period. It's a frightening period because the forces that are in power now are very terrible, dangerous, reactionary forces. No doubt about that. But at the same time, I see this wonderful energy that's there and an awakening consciousness cutting across big swaths of the American people, especially among young people. And young people are always going to be the hope for the future. So there's no reason that we can't have a better future. When I sort of begin the book at the age of 11 on VJ Day, when everybody, all those kids and all the adults, we all thought this was it. We're going to live in a peaceful and prosperous nation and world. And here we are with clearly the strongest economic and military power in the world, with all our pretension. We could have that. We could live on a peaceful planet. We could live with a wonderful education system, health system. All this is possible. It's a question of consciousness and action, and the two are related. One of the main lessons of the movement, of my own participation and all the other tens of millions of other people, is that the way consciousness changes is when you try to change reality. When you try to change reality, you learn a lot more about that reality.
That's true.
That's what's necessary.
Oh, my God, that is so true. And that's really interesting because I know a lot of people sitting on their hands or they can't handle it, and I know a lot of activists. And I keep consistently aligning with the activists because that's how you, you know, broaden the opportunity for making the change rather than prejudging that you cannot and sort of backing away from it and not really growing in a certain respect. I think it's a really key point. We're coming to the end of our conversation here. We've been talking today on Connect the Dots with H. Bruce Franklin, the author of Crash Course, From the Good War to the Forever War. It's a publication of Rutgers University Press. Bruce is a cultural historian and, you know, has lived over a broad sweep of recent history and learned and grown from it, as he details in his book. How can people stay in touch with you? Do you have a website that they can follow?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Allison. Yeah, that's the best way. It's called hbrucefranklin.com. So that's just my name, hbrucefranklin.com. And lots of stuff is there, including my email address. So that's not private, and so people can get and learn about the work, but they can also get in touch with me that way. And also it has a listing of coming events where I can meet people.
Oh, terrific. Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots. It's really been really terrifically integrative to look at this from your broad perspective, as you've shared with us today and as you've detailed in the book. You know, so much appreciate your coming on the show.
Well, thank you so much,
Professor Franklin. And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. If the events that we're discussing somewhat on this show are still happening, please go to www.cancelkavanaugh.com, figure out ways to be involved. Thank you for being with us, and we'll be back next week. Have a great week. I'm Allison Rose Levy.